This is Becky Carmel, and I am sitting with my oral history summer school classmate, Elizabeth Shaw, in the blue room of Solaris on June 24th, 2018. And we will be having a loosely focused interview on the theme of care. Elizabeth, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, this is Elizabeth Shaw. I can confirm that it's June 24th, 2018, and we are in the blue room at Solaris.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Tell me about who you care for.
I care for, in the most traditional sense, my two nephews, who are 5 and 3 and a half, my sister's children. They live in Brooklyn Heights in New York, and I live in Prospect Heights in New York. Their mother and I work at the same school, which is the school that their father attended when he was a child. And when the students all are, my nephews also attend the school as very young students. And I spend about, I would say, 3 or 4 nights a week. I sleep over at my sister's house, and that can vary. Especially based on my schedule, because let's put it this way, I don't oversleep when I'm staying at my sister's house. I'm woken pretty early in the morning. And I'm also, I try to make sure that at least one day out of the weekend, I'm there for when they wake up, and I'm there for their bedtime, there for bath time, and also there to, I take them out, and sometimes I'll take them for, a full day, or sometimes I'll take them out for just half the day. To go to my place, to go to the museum, to go to the park. And I care for them in this way because, first of all, I love my sister. And when my first nephew was born, when Leo was born, I knew that I wanted to be involved in childcare because as a feminist and as somebody who had a working mother, I knew how hard it was to have a family and to balance a career with childcare, with a private life. And I wanted as much as possible to help my sister and her husband as they were adjusting. And I took a week off of medical leave to care for Leo as a baby after my sister had her maternity leave. And luckily my immediate supervisor, Colleen Dundon, is a devoted aunt herself, and she made no difficulties about me taking that time, even though, under Family and Medical Leave Act, it's not a recognized relationship. But her sister was very sick for a long time, and Colleen had a very important role in her niece and nephew's lives, and I think that she really understands what it's like to want to be a part of a family and to have sort of these non-recognized relationships that aren't like recognized by the state or recognized by insurance companies, but are nevertheless really important. And I felt really lucky to be able to do that, and I really fell in love with my nephew, and I think he's wonderful. I love spending time with him. So I kept that up, and I have really been sustained by it, but I also see how much different my involvement is than the involvement that my sister and her husband have, and what it's like to be somebody who has the choice to come over, and what it's like to be somebody who is on deck all the time. I also see that it is, it can be very challenging, it can be very exhausting, and in a way, when I come over and I have a lot of energy and I'm ready to play with the kids, my sister is kind of like, oh my God, how do you have so much energy? And I'm like, it's because I have the choice to come over and I have the choice to walk away. So I feel really lucky in that my care is valued and that my care is helpful. But I also recognize that there's a difference between the type of care I give and the type of care that my sister and her husband give. And that seems obvious, but I just wanted to state it explicitly. I consider my job a caring profession job. I'm a librarian in an elementary school. Books were centrally important to me as a child and centrally important to me today. And I think of helping children find pleasure and purpose in reading is a very important form of care. There's sort of the technical bibliotherapy, which is not something that I technically engage in, although I've studied it, I've taken classes in it. But just the idea that knowing what people like and in some sense intuiting what they need or what they might benefit from is an important form of care that I give my kids. I also, the library is sort of one of those third spaces at the school where it's not the lunchroom. It's not like a common space that you only have access to at a certain time. And it's not the classroom, which is governed by your teacher and has very specific rules. But it's a place that is more flexible and open to kids and also has a lot of potential for doing what interests or excites or serves your emotional and your intellectual development. So the things that I have in the library that I've added over the years, because when I came in, it was a room filled with books and it was a room filled with wonderful books. And I think that there's a lot of healing to be had in a room that's full of books. But over time, I've added things like we have a sewing machine, we have a piano, we have a garden, we have a little hydroponic garden, we have a cart that's filled with recycled materials. And we also I have a ongoing and vast collection of things that have fragrances. And I've tried to make them as non-toxic as possible because I don't, it's not like I'm handing them scented Crayola markers and telling them to have a field day. But in terms of dried herbs, and there's a company called the Demeter Scent Library that makes different things. So having them be able to soothe themselves and stimulate themselves with a number of different activities, and also the ability just to be absorbed in making something, because there are many kids at that age who are not yet capable of being absorbed in books and absorbed in reading, and that feeling of kind of weightless involvement in directed activity or purposeful activity, I think is incredibly healing and incredibly important. At least it has been for me in my life, and everything I have a lot of confirmation bias about this, but there's also a lot of research and work to support that idea. So in that sense, I care for a large population of children. I care for my brother. My brother has been depressed for most of his life, and his depression it's quite severe, and I cared for him a lot as a child, in like the most early and basic sense of he had really bad night terrors, and I would be the only person who heard him because our house was quite large. So I would care for him during those times. And I viewed it as my responsibility, and I was like kind of jealous of my responsibility. If somebody else tried to do it, I'd be like, no, this is me, this is mine. He, as he's grown up, he is a talented, accomplished, dedicated, and good person. And when he needs people to be with him, that's something that I, and as well as my father, sort of do for him and care for him in that way. He married when he was, I think, 27 or 28. And the woman that he married, I think her perspective on care was ultimately what ended their relationship. And she felt that in a marriage, that the husband's job is to care for the wife, and financially, emotionally, and in terms of doing housework, in terms of what job he would take, in terms of how he would behave towards her in terms of also what she was allowed to say or do to him, in order to alleviate her feelings of like anger and distress. And my brother, I feel guilty in some way that that wasn't something that we saw earlier, because by the time the problems in their relationship became evident, it was through my brother's incredible mental distress and the deterioration of his mental health. And at that point, although I spoke to both of them fairly regularly, I stopped speaking to my brother's wife, and because I felt like I fundamentally misjudged the situation, and that I had thought that in a marriage, two people tend to care for each other, and I had sort of kind of abdicated some of that responsibility, or I had felt like, okay, well, if there's anything really going on, then my brother's wife will be the first person on the scene. And then once it became apparent that he was kind of in danger from himself, and that she was exacerbating the situation considerably, and also that she was eager to sort of absolve herself of any responsibility of care by having him institutionalized, then that was sort of the signal for our family to kind of converge on him and try to, you know, give him, restore some of that care to him, and restore access to meaningful, dignified care that somebody really close to him was trying to take away. And that, so ever since, you know, he's doing much better since their split and since their divorce. And obviously depression is something he'll struggle with through his life. You know, I think the balance of our relationship has been restored, where he cares for me, you know, we call each other, we support each other, we share our concerns. But I hope that, in the same way that I was sort of jealous of my responsibility to care for him as a child, like, I hope to have the opportunity to care for him for a very long time to come. I would say that I care for my parents in very different ways. My parents are both still relatively healthy, thank God. And my father, I care for him basically by helping to care for Daniel and to care for my nephews, because he wishes he could do more, but he works and he's busy, and he feels supported and cared for by the fact that I do that and I tell him sort of what's been going on. And my mother and I have a fraught relationship around care, because she has had significant health challenges since I was a child, and from before that as well. She had a very severe migraine disorder, and that, you know, I don't know if you've had migraines, but for just to orient anybody who does not have migraines, it's a seizure, a disorder, and it can manifest in many different ways because it's disruptions in the cortex of the brain, sensory cortex. And so it can cause nausea, it can cause blindness, it can cause dizziness, frustration, and obviously like intense pain. And it can go on for days and weeks at a time. So my mother had what are called atypical migraines, where she didn't have an aura or a premonition. And she kind of came of age in a time where there wasn't a treatment, and there was a lot of sexism in the medical industry, and it was dismissed as an imaginary disease or a woman's disease. And because, you know, many sufferers of migraine are women, that's partially due to hormones, it's partially due to, you know, emotional stress, it's also just partially due to societal sexism and environmental challenges that women face. And so she kind of grew, she had this experience of not being believed, and then being given treatments that were very not really useful. So, you know, the types of painkillers that she could take didn't really do anything. Or, you know, the advice that she would get as to what not to eat and what not to do and where not to be, You know, this incredibly restrictive advice that really didn't have much of a chance of working. And if it didn't work, then it was very easy for people around her to say, well, were you doing this and were you doing that? And were you also doing this? And have you tried this? Which I think is an experience that a lot of chronic pain sufferers share. And during this time, she was sustaining like a pretty high-powered career at the National Gallery in Washington. So working and also raising, this was also when she was going to college, going to grad school, getting married, having children, and dealing with this. And this was sort of concurrent with the development of the traditional or with the widespread drugs that are used today to control migraine, which are called the triptan drugs. Imitrex is probably the most common brand name. So, and then when she would have access to Imitrex, when Imitrex became a therapy, it was expensive. Insurance would only cover a certain number of shots. They were ludicrous, like really expensive, because it wasn't as if she and my father weren't making good money, and they were, but it was just profoundly, profoundly expensive. And so she would ration shots, and she wouldn't be able to. And she also had really, she had some vascular issues, so she would have these incredible bruises, and she, you know, there are some drugs she couldn't take because of the increased risk of clots. So I knew about all of this as a kid, and my mom, you know, one thing that helped her was a type of foot massage, basically, and that was something that I could do for her and nobody else could do for her. And so I did that a lot, and I felt like a real sense of responsibility to take care of her and to, in some way, make sure that she didn't suffer from these migraines. And there were times when I didn't want to, and there were times like but I did, because I felt like, of course, you're going to do that. Like, somebody you love is in pain, you have to take care of them. But it's, looking back again, it's like I felt proud of my role in taking care of her, but I wish that, I think it's hard for a child to be put into a position where they feel like they have that type of power over their parent, or where they feel like they have that kind of responsibility toward their parent. And I've spoken a little bit about this, but she also, I mean, everybody in our family has depression, has anxiety, has attention deficit disorder. And that's all five of us, I guess I should say. And so we were kind of like a volatile, high needs family. And there was a lot of pressure to emotionally caretake for my mom. And so for a long time, I was also her primary confidant. And also, I just really felt like it was my job to be as present and loving and open and welcoming and not troublemaking, as far as was possible, which was, difficult and more difficult as I became an adult. So that was the caretaking relationship then. And now it's a little bit more guarded. Partially because my mom had developed a degenerative back disorder, which caused her a lot of chronic pain. The migraines didn't go away, but they were managed to an extent, but a lot of back pain and nerve pain, which is really, really hard to deal with. And she sort of kind of went into this realm where there wasn't anything that I could do. And you know, what I could do wasn't working. So I had that experience of like helplessness, but also of feeling like, well, this is in somebody else's hands. I can't fix this. And then after she divorced from my father, I felt just totally unsure of our relationship, unsure of our family's relationship, because it kind of came through in a way where, I would say that it was kind of, she felt a failure of care. She felt she wasn't cared for by my father. She wasn't cared for by his children, and that she wanted to be in a place, like geographically, she wanted to live in a place and be with somebody who she felt cared for her. And for the greater or lesser part, that's been true. She's been with her partner, Brian, for a long time now, and he does take good care of her. And living in a smaller town and not having to drive and being in a place that has a really supportive Jewish community has been, I think, that she feels cared for. And she's been able to make some pretty strong relationships to the point where she refers to people as her son or her daughter, which I would just like to put on record. I wonder how she would feel if I called people my mother. I'm so grateful that she has those relationships, and I think that they're a reflection of her desire to connect and care and be cared for. So I'm sort of looking forward to the time when my mother needs more help. And the way I've felt over the past 5 years has been very allergic to the idea of caring for her in more than like a, I care for you, I love you, let's hang, you know, like, let's see each other way, but in the sense of like assuming responsibility for checking up on her medications and for scheduling doctor's appointments and for helping her physically. And I've kind of like been steeling myself for that because I want to, and I know it's the right thing to do, but I feel completely overwhelmed when I think about it. And I know that however I feel, my siblings have an even stronger reaction because they each have their own emotional history with my mom. And while we all love her, we all are very, you know, sensitive people, and sensitive people, not in like a, oh, touchy-feely way, but in a like sensitive skin way where like it erupts and gets angry and red at the slightest provocation. So we're all kind of, we have strong emotional reactions to things and our own challenges, as I'm sure it's been apparent. So I guess I am a once and future caretaker for my mother, and I am a current caretaker for my students, my nephews, in a way my sister, and also, you know, my friends. I do my best to care for them and to take care of them, and I have one really close sort of primary friendship with somebody who has had a difficult and traumatic year. And so for a while, taking care of her as she cared for herself was a major investment of time. I think there's not, besides all of those people, no. I would say that's my burden of care. Those are the people to whom I direct my care, and in almost every case by whom I'm cared for in return.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that, Elizabeth. Would you tell me more about your feminism and your caregiving?
Sure. I went to a girls' school, and I went to a women's college. I took a little break in the meantime to go to a co-ed high school down in Virginia that was majority men because it was science and tech focused, or majority boys, I should say. They were certainly not men. And during that time, I really became very convinced in some ways that sort of the best model for cooperative caretaking is cooperative, and is, I guess I really conceived of it mostly in terms of women doing the work, because sort of that's what I was seeing in my life, and those were the strongest bonds that I was taking. And I also, my parents had a more traditional division of labor, and I sort of spent some time unpacking that, and I never liked being cared for by somebody who wasn't also like connected to our family or being cared for in return. That was an uncomfortable position for me. So babysitters, I often was I felt uncomfortable with. Housekeeping, I felt uncomfortable with. And so I think my favorite caregiving models were ones like being on a team, being part of a group of volunteers. Like I worked at a colonial reenactment farm in Virginia for several years, and then when I went to college, there was not only was there just the college itself, but I belonged to a group of friends who did take responsibility for caring for sick people and caring for. You know, helping each other out and just being like, oh, she's having a really hard time right now. Can somebody go check on her? Can somebody do this? Can somebody bring her lunch? And it felt really natural to me. And it also felt like you could talk with peers, whereas whenever I had to explain why or how I needed to get care or to give care to somebody who was from a more privileged position, it felt really infuriating. So, I kind of stopped engaging and be like, and to make the very a very abstract, a diffuse statement, like tangible. When my mom was dealing with the after effects of some surgeries, talking with my brother about caring for her, I really was not greeted with like, oh, of course. Or even like, it was like, I had to be the case manager. Like I had to be the person who said, this is what happens here. And this is what happens here. And I just was like, this is, you know, this is not okay. And I wonder, you know, even now as I'm saying this, it's like, how am I helping women by absolving men of responsibility? And I certainly don't think that's the case. But I also think that what goes around comes around. And, I think that my commitment towards taking care of the women in my life and helping the women in my life share their caretaking burdens is an investment that I'm making in relationships that will come back to help me. And not being like, I'm not shy about telling people why I do what I do. And I think that... as somebody who is not very focused on forming a family and who has a lot of reservations about forming a family, primarily because of the amount of care that it takes, I'm glad for the opportunity to be involved. And because I have a job that supports me, I can do it for my sister for free. And she can, you know, she can pay me back in things like opportunities and food and support and like, you know, all these other financial, I mean, she would pay me. There are times when she has paid me for things that are specifically onerous or when she really needs to make sure that I, like, if she's like, I need to reserve your time this far in advance. And I'll be like, okay, then, you know, this is a time where it would be appropriate for you to compensate me. But I think that I have a real stake in the kids, my nephews. I feel like I have a real investment and I'm treated that way by my sister. You know, I'm able to, when I express concerns or when I have desires for what experiences they should have or what lessons that they might learn, I'm really listened to. And I think that that's kind of a kickback on the care that I give. So I know that women's fields and caring fields are underpaid, and I know it's because of undervaluing women's labor. And I'm still thinking of ways that I can address that and ways that I can stop that. But many of my friends have also kind of expressed the desire to ultimately live in kind of a communal style. And I also, it's hard for me to get motivated about economic things because I'm very privileged, and I'm privileged in the people I know, I'm privileged in the resources that I have access to. So part of me is like, well, if they don't want to pay me this much, that's fine. But I know that that's not the case for most women. I know that's not the case for most people. So I've also tried to be more, like I can ask for more, and then I can, if I'm feeling bad about it, I can give what I make that I don't need away. Like that is certainly possible. Yeah. So I think that I see like a very communal feminist path forward in like more sharing of responsibility, and in more transparency about the work that people put in and what they're given in return. So that's what I'd that's what I would describe as the connection between my feminism and my care. Oh, also, I mean, this, I feel like this goes without saying, but I educate my children with respect for care and respect for labor. And we, more so in the past like 3 or 4 years, I was pretty strongly influenced by one of my coworkers in this regard. But I teach a lot of very privileged kids, and I teach a lot of very privileged young boys, and I try to make, I just really try to make it explicit how much work goes into everything that they see. And the fact that when we talk about implicit bias, and when we talk about what affects the information people remember and use, I'm really trying to educate them to recognize the labor that people do, and to recognize why some of that labor goes unnoticed and unrewarded.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm still thinking about that idea of investments return.
Mm.
And I'm curious if you would tell me more about ways that you have felt your investments of care returned.
I mean, with... I mean, the phrase that's blocking me from really speaking right now is the phrase, you can't eat fulfillment. And I think that that's extremely, extremely accurate. But I do feel fulfilled in many ways by opportunities to care and by the relationships that I get with the people I care for. I have a strong need to feel like I am helping people. I have a strong need to feel like my actions are in some way making the world a better place and leading towards a sort of more just future. So when I see that my nephews have a strong bond with me and they want to read the books I recommend and they want to come and like cuddle with me and they want to go to the things that I want to take them to and see the music and go to the museums, I feel like I am having a chance to sort of educate and shape to future citizens, you know, to future people. I also, and this may be completely not come to pass, but I also feel that as I'm getting older and as I age, that my nephews will want to participate in some way with my care. And I certainly, the care that I get from my sister and from my brother when I'm sick, when I'm sad, when I need reminders to do things, I get this sort of reciprocal attention. As far as teaching goes, I mean, I am compensated. And I am also... I do feel, I wish it was more so, and certainly this could all be accomplished by raising teachers' salaries, but the opportunity to educate myself, to have new experiences, to go to new places, to network with colleagues, like these are all things that make me, those are ways that my school or my institution invests in me and things that I can take to other places and I can negotiate with. So I would say that, like, I don't really like being cared for, it makes me uncomfortable to have people go out of their way for me and to have people be responsible for me. But I would say that when it's really counted and when I've really needed it, the people that I've cared for have been more than happy to care for me in return. I don't have a feeling of being hung out to dry. And in fact, I have a feeling of being supported. I'm uncomfortable while I'm being supported, but it's something that happens. So I would say that's kind of, I invest in my relationships, and I expect and I receive a return on them, although I worry about the sort of persistence and of those sort of returns, right? Because my school, I would love to be cared for by my school in the sense of like a contract that lasts for more than 1 year. And I would like to be cared for by my school. You know, recently they tried to convince us that we'd be better off with an HSA rather than health insurance. Cause they were like, we can't sustain these rising healthcare costs. And I was like, you can't sustain those rising healthcare costs. So I think that, I would love to be in a more labor friendly environment. Yeah, and when I think about forming a family, my therapist pointed this out to me. I never really envision having a partner who helps me. And that's a big obstacle to the idea of forming a family. So I guess that's the time when I do not feel like I would get a significant return on my investment. And so therefore, I don't undertake that specific type of caring. Yeah. I would say that's true.
What might receiving a more comfortable care be like for you?
Sometimes care for me feels like being left alone, and like being relieved of obligations. Receiving a more comfortable care might even be me becoming more comfortable with delegating some responsibilities, and with being more fairly compensated for the things that are hardest for me. I think that people, in a non-financial sense, I think that being cared for more comfortably would be people saying, either releasing me from obligations and saying, you don't have to do this, or somebody saying, you know, I know you want to do this to help this person, or I know you want to do this to fulfill this responsibility, I'm going to do it for you. And that would sort of joining in with that act of caring. You know, when people, like a lot of times I'll be, you know, if I'm having like a downswing in my mental health and I need to rest more, like my sleep needs go up, I would say that one way my school supports me, whether they know it or not, is they have completely accepted me having a more of a flex schedule. And coming in later and staying and potentially staying later, but having a flexible schedule in response to the work that I have to do. And my colleagues, I would say, support me I feel comfortable with the support that I get from my colleagues when they let me reschedule classes or reschedule meetings, helping me, creating the space and the opportunity for me to self-care is something that I really value when I receive it as care. And, you know, yeah, I think that's it. I'm trying to think of my personal relationships. I mean, my friends will sometimes offer me care in ways that they'll be like, you know, I know you don't like to do this, but I'm really asking you. And then it feels like I'm caring for them by giving them the opportunity to care for me. So they've discovered like a little short circuit. And I would say that that is usually pretty effective. And it just shows that I have very smart and emotionally manipulative friends, which are two qualities I highly value. Yeah. I would love to be cared for by the state in the sense that they stop trying to kill people that I love. And I would love to be cared for by my country and by having the environment that I live in and that the world that people I love live in, is, not going to be polluted and destroyed. So that's a major, it is a major form of care that I feel is absent and I would be very comfortable receiving. The stress that my friends are under from student loans, and the stress that my friends are under from healthcare responsibilities and from violence and from, you know, discrimination, that absence of care is, I would love to have that relieved. I would be very comfortable having, I would not be uncomfortable, receiving that type of care from my government and from my society.
Tell me more about self-care for you.
So self-care for me is mostly about not beating up on myself or not performing self-care in the way that's anticipated. Because I have multiple mental health, diagnoses, I guess you would say, although I feel that they're all part of an organic whole. I don't really see it as like, well, this is my depression and this is my anxiety and this is my commitment to helping others and this is my existential despair. When I'm depressed, I want to be able to be depressed without feeling like a failure. Like, I just want to experience what I'm experiencing. And working towards that is a form of self-care. There's definitely ways in which I don't care for myself, which I feel would improve my mental health. Like, I used to love makeup, and I used to love doing cool things with my hair. And I used to love long baths and like all sorts of poofy stuff like that, which is commonly marketed as self-care today, which I obviously have a lot of feelings about because, you know, it's expensive. First of all, it keeps an industry afloat. A lot of the products are not ethically made. A lot of it is sort of geared towards making women more like sexually appealing or sexually attractive to straight men. I guess I've just listed like some of the sort of ostensible reasons that I've stopped doing it or that I resist it, especially right after the 2016 election. I just had this like, fuck this, you know, and one of my like most beloved female mentors, who was a parent of one of my students, you know, she had been dyeing her hair for 20 years because she went gray quite early, and she just stopped. And I was like, that's how I feel. I just wanted to stop. I'm sick of putting this doesn't feel like it's for me anymore. I'm bitter about that. I'm bitter that things that used to feel like self-care don't feel like that anymore. And in the same way, I was an athlete and very active for a long time, as a rower and as a basketball player. And I went through kind of, I guess, I don't know what you call it. It's like exercise anorexia or something like that. I went through a really, through this period of weight loss and like obsession with what I was eating and obsession with working out. And because of that, I have a hard time going back into the gym and not experiencing those feelings and not experiencing that. And I'm like also bitter about that because it's hard. There's not very many places, very many rooms that are filled with gym equipment that you can walk into and not receive like conscious and subconscious messages about what you should be doing there and what the purpose of your activity is. So there's a lot of work to do on reclaiming some of that stuff that's helpful. But there's also a lot of opportunities to just say, I'm doing other things, you know, like nobody's ruined reading for me yet, for which I'm very grateful. College tried, didn't work. Nobody's ruined like cuddling my nephews. Nobody has ruined like taking walks in the outside, you know? So giving myself permission to be like, you know what? It's okay that you're not going to the gym. It's okay that you are not, you know, painting your nails. Like, it's fine that you're not doing any of that stuff. That, I think, is the most caring thing that I do for myself right now. So, and also staying off of the internet in some ways. There's a lot of social media, and I'm very attuned to information. I love knowing things. I'm nosy. I want to know. I feel like knowing is a way of controlling. If I know what's happening, then I can control how it's going to come out for me. And Twitter has been really addictive in that regard, because it makes you feel like you know everything that's happening, but really you know nothing that's happening. You know what's happening on Twitter. And Twitter has its own subculture. And it's just remarkable to watch it unfold, but it's not helpful in terms of... it's helpful for some things. It's helpful for the work that I do and being aware of new media. It's helpful for making me aware of... I follow a lot of Indigenous activists on Twitter. I follow a lot of political organizers on Twitter. So it has its uses, but then it also can just take away time. And being aware of like the economy of your time and what you're getting out of it. Again, just return to the investment and returns thing. So that's like the opposite of self-care for me. So if something can be defined by its opposite... that is one of those ways. And then, so I have a obsessive personality, I would say. And I became very interested in family. I've always been interested in family history, but I finally bit the bullet and began paying more for access to an ancestry database. And I lose hours building out family trees that are sometimes mine and sometimes they're other people's. I love it. Sometimes I do it by request. Sometimes I get paid for it. But that's like, I find that to be a form of self-care, because I love just like diving into the past and making those connections. And I also like bringing that knowledge forward, because it's given me a whole new perspective on how people came to be where they are in America today. I would say that's a form of self-care for me.
I'm thinking about what you said about knowing as a form of controlling.
Yeah.
And it's bringing me to wonder, what are some things you wish you knew?
That's such a hard question for a librarian, because, you know, a big part of information science for me, and I've taken classes in library school, but I don't have a formal MLS. I don't have a formal degree in information studies. But I feel overwhelmed by expansive information and the ways in which access to information is almost the same thing as whether or not that information exists. Like if there's a piece of information that I can't get access to, then for me it's like it doesn't exist. And I feel... like very limited by my capacity to act on information. Like I know things and I don't, but I can't do things. And this is sort of a ongoing reaction to my kind of educational history, where I knew I had to do things, but I could not do them. And so I knew that I had to do, like at a very young age, I knew I had to keep track of my library books, but I could not do it. And I knew I had to do my homework, but I could not do it. And I had this professor who, generally speaking, I loved, and who was very kind to me, and really, not kind to me, I would say that he understood the effort that I was putting out, and he respected it. But he was like, well, I don't think... Plato has this whole thing. I think it's Plato. He has this whole thing about it's not possible to know the good and not to do it. I'm like, fuck you. It is absolutely possible to know the good and not to do it. I know, for example, you know, like it takes issues of attention and capacity and compulsion and paralysis just completely out of the question. So I wish I knew how it was possible. I wish I knew how it was possible to motivate myself to behave in the ways that I want to behave. Because I feel very like at the mercy of my brain chemistry, or at the mercy of other people, or at the mercy of, you know, whatever I happen to be thinking about. And I think, you know, from an obsessive standpoint, I wish I knew how to have more conscious control over the things that I think and the things that I do. So I guess it's like a meta answer. I mean, from like a more frivolous level, the lost civilizations and lost people and lost times and lost languages. I wish I knew like every language there ever was. I wish I knew, you know, what exactly was happening, you know, when like a specific artisan was making a specific pot in Crete like 3,000 years ago. Those are the things I wish I knew. But yes, in the here and now, I wish I knew how to make myself do the things that I need to do. And I wish I also knew what I need to do in order to make the change that I want to see in the world come about. Because one of the ways that people don't act is they convince themselves that they haven't figured out how to act first. And I just think that, yeah, having more confidence and more certainty in either a specific action to take or a specific reason not to act would be really helpful for me in the work that I try to do.
I'm still thinking about your mention of paralysis, but I'm wondering how passivity has shown up in your life.
Passivity is a quality which I think that for a long time I interpreted as a form of care, of being pliable, being agreeable, not expressing a preference. And I think that for that reason, taking an active stance on something or actively expressing something can feel very hostile to me, can feel very aggressive. And that's obviously an irrational thought. It's obviously a distortion, to use the lingo. So true passivity, which is experiencing without acting, I think is hard to find. And I think that that can be an important part of somebody's practice, can be an important part of somebody's sort of spiritual life. I don't think much of it is like a political stance. And I'm constantly trying to find ways to work around my own tendency towards passivity. And not going along to get along until I can't anymore, but rather, you know, I would say that I sometimes expect other people to interpret a lack of passivity on my part as really aggressive and really hostile, and that's not the case. People actually kind of like it when other people express preferences, and you know, a lot of people are very comfortable saying, okay, I hear you, that doesn't work for me, and then you can move on to the next step. And but nobody wants you to agree and then just be like boiling in sort of like rage or frustration about having to do something you don't even want to do. Yeah, I would say that like I'm the second child in a family where my sister has a very strong temperament, and sometimes I laugh at myself because I work at the school where she works. You know, I spend my time taking care of her children, We rarely fight. We fight more now than we... Well, we had a very high period of fighting until I was about 18, and then almost no fighting. And now we're sort of fighting again, which I think is healthy. But trying to please everybody kind of left me with a habit of passivity, but also a negative outlook on passivity, I think, has been part of my adult learning. But there's something actually... you, the person who's interviewing me, if I can just break the fourth wall for a second, you remind me really strongly of a girl who I went to college with, and she said something once, which I think she was trying to help me. I was expressing some distress, and she was like, "Do you ever think of yourself as like a flat stone in the river with water rushing around you?" And I was like, "No, but that's an interesting thought. The idea that you can let things happen around you and even to you and not react either externally or internally, and the world doesn't collapse, can be a helpful thought."
That's so interesting. Thank you for breaking the fourth wall to share that with me. I was thinking, when you were talking about what pleases others, I was wondering, what pleases you, Elizabeth?
So, what pleases me is having a lot of time to myself, but also being around people who genuinely seem to enjoy my company. And I think that what pleases me is having time to do the things that I want to do, and to make things, and to make things in the way that I make them, which is usually working for 5 minutes at a time and coming back 2 weeks later. And to be in situations where I feel like valued, which can have a plus and a minus, but I would have to say I like it. It pleases me. And it pleases me to have opportunities to help other people, and to encourage other people to do the same thing. I feel really pleased when people join me in doing things that help others, because I feel not just like they're doing a good thing, but also that they will come to enjoy it. I have a very, perhaps unwarranted confidence that people will enjoy the same things that I enjoy, which serves me pretty well as a librarian, and I think also as an activist or an educator. I love anything that results in the creation of something new. So I love cooking, I love sewing, I love talking to people and exchanging ideas. I've realized it's shifted over to what I love instead of what pleases me, and recognizing the open nature of the format. Gardens please me, being outside pleases me. Being comfortable. I really love being comfortable. That's one of the things that I was quite passive about as a child, is that if I was uncomfortable, I would not really say why, or I would make up reasons why things needed to change, but it was never because I was uncomfortable. So I was like, oh, I think people might be uncomfortable, or I think I'm sick, you know, rather than like, I don't want to go to swim practice anymore, or I am feeling really nervous about this test, or I don't like these pants. These pants are too tight. Those were all things that I kind of didn't say, and instead I would say things like, I think it's going to rain. I don't want to be on the river if it's going to rain. Or I think I'm having an asthma attack. I was a big faker. because, you know, it felt like okay to say there's something physically wrong with my body than to say there's something emotionally going on with me. Or there's something that you did that's making me feel uncomfortable. Problems with the body felt like acts of God, and anything else felt like an accusation against the person, or sort of an admission of weakness.
How do you know now, as grown Elizabeth, when you are comfortable?
It's an ongoing process. And there's, you know, there's good comfort and there's bad comfort. And there's the kind of comfort that, you know, makes you really unwilling to leave it, even if you need to. So, like, when I'm trapped on Twitter and I'm feeling like, you know, I'm just losing time, losing hours. And I guess then there is a sense of discomfort that arises. I try to check in with myself, and I try to check on how my body is doing. Like, these are pretty remedial things, but like, where's my posture? What are my hands doing? Like, really kind of viewing myself as an outsider, and identifying what's going on. Like, even things like heart rate, or am I sweating? I developed a panic disorder over the past couple of years, and it was related to sort of an ongoing experience I had where I was teaching in like an unsafe environment, and loud noises and kids yelling became like a really powerful panic trigger for me. And that was when I started to really understand about, you know, your body won't always, your brain won't always tell you what's going on, but your body usually will. And so since that time, I've been more attuned to my physicality. And emotionally, you know, I always experience a certain degree of discomfort, emotionally and, sort of anxiety wise, but I think that a big part of the therapeutic work that I've done over the decades, oh my God, is identifying like specific thoughts that occur, and like if I hear that thought, I'm like, okay, this is associated with a feeling, and if I can change that thought, I can change the feeling. I've been the delighted recipient of a lot of care over the years, partially by virtue of my family and having doctors in the family and psychiatrists in the family and therapists in the family, and partially by virtue of having excellent access to healthcare. So I would say that might be the bulk of the care that I've received in many different ways, which I'm grateful for. I find it helpful. So paying attention to my thoughts and to my body, and just noticing what's going on.
Thank you for that. How do you know when the children in your life are comfortable?
I know when the children in my life are comfortable because they are absorbed. I feel like that quality of absorption, or that quality of, or even just happiness, like, although it's hard because sometimes when a child is really seeking attention and seeking connection, it's because they're not comfortable. And sometimes when a kid is withdrawn, it's, you know, it's not that they're absorbed in what they're doing, it's because they're trying to manage a feeling. I don't know. I think it's hard to tell. There's a sense of mirroring. Like, if you look at a kid and you start to get a feeling, then you're probably picking up on how they're holding themselves. And kids have a very different, as you know, have a very different, like, habitus, I guess is the technical word, but like, they, when they move and when they touch and when they like do all these different things, I'm sort of gesturing with my hands to like show a child who's sort of climbing and exploring and twitching and doing all those things. I mean, even like a tick, like a child can be completely relaxed and still have a tick, and they're not necessarily uncomfortable. Also, like, a child can be sitting in a way where an adult would mean you would be in traction for 3 weeks, but it's literally the most comfortable that they can be. And that is a never-ending source of amusement to me. I remember being like that, but I no longer have that experience. With babies, it's kind of funny because, like, you know if a baby is comfortable because they're not, like, wailing. Right. And there's also like, it's kind of like Sims. Like, if you fed them recently, and if they've slept recently, and if they've received care and playtime recently, like, unless there's something organically wrong with them, they should be comfortable. So and sometimes you do need to treat yourself like that. You need to be like, hey, have I done this recently? and that can address issues you're not aware of. But yeah, I don't really know. I find children to be kind of, I guess, black boxes in that way, where it's like, I know if we do this, we'll get this out, but I don't really know what's happening inside the box. A lot of respect for people who do.
What are some ways that you are still a black box to yourself?
Oof. Many different ways. I guess I'm still trying to resolve the difference between how I view myself and the things that I do. Like, I think of myself as being an introvert, but I get really sad when school ends and I'm not having hundreds of social interactions throughout the day. I think of myself as being an activist, but do I always stand up for things that I know are wrong in a community? Like, I think that I know, like, I think that some things would be too difficult, but really they're probably not. The way anxiety distorts my thinking, that is a very, like, sort of black box aspect to me, and it's related to, like, what I want to know. I'm kind of on hiatus from thinking about myself in interpersonal relationships, like romantic relationships. I've taken a nice long break, and it's been really good. Because previously I felt like I really was in a caretaking relationship with the people that I was seeing. And I, again, sort of this allergic reaction that I had with my mom also came to the forefront in those relationships, where I was just like, and then I didn't have like a literal, you know, childhood and adolescence of somebody taking care of me and, you know, deserving reciprocal care. So like, I don't really know what I want in a relationship or if I want a relationship. And I think that I'm engaging in some self-care and not dealing with it again, just like not really trying to dig into that too much. But again, it's hard to say what drives inaction sometimes. It's hard to say what the issue is. Yeah. So sort of confusion about that, or uncertainty. I also have no idea when I'm going to wake up in the morning, which is the type of uncertainty that really bothers me. Sometimes it's 5 hours, sometimes it's 12 hours. I could really use a little bit more knowledge about that, foreknowledge even.
I would like to know, as a children's librarian and also devoted aunt, what some of your favorite children's books that you, in some way or another, use as tools of care with the children in your life. I'd like to know what some of those favorite books are.
There is a wonderful book that's called The Room of Wonders by somebody named Sergio Rizzier. He's an Italian children's book author and illustrator who lives in Brooklyn, and I've heard that he's quite an odd duck, as many people involved in children's literature are. This book is about a rat named Pius, or Pius, I guess it would be a more Italian. It's clearly an Italian rat. And he has a room of wonders. He has a whole room that's devoted to things that he found. And they're both wonderful in the sense that some of them are quite lovely and interesting, but also they just make you wonder. So he has like a dried leaf that's shaped like a dog. He has a glass eye. He has a bunch of things nobody knows what they do. And it's just like a huge room filled with these things. And so the course of the book is basically a bird comes over, like a very angry bird, who actually looks like a character from the game Angry Birds, even though this book came out a decade and a half prior to that game. And he's like, what is this doing? Like, there's one rock, this gray pebble. It's under glass. It's in the middle of the room. He's like, what is this doing here? It's so boring. You should get rid of it. So he trashes it. He throws it away. And then the entire book goes to black and white. And he doesn't go out. He's like lies flat on his back in his room for like 3 days. And and then on the third day he gets up, he walks out, and he picks up a rock, and he remembers the first time that he saw the other rock, and he wondered where it had come from and what it had seen. And then he goes back and he starts collecting again. And I use that book to help students think about what they really love doing and why they love doing it. And what challenges they might face from other people. And it's kind of like perfect because like, why is he collecting all those things? Like that's a hoarder. Like that's, you know, that's somebody who's displaying hoarding behaviors. But, and I also love that's kind of a joke because he's literally a pack rat. But he loves it. Other people get benefit out of it. Like two people, like one person says, ugh, this is dumb. And he stops doing it? That's not okay. And a lot of, it can be a great jumping off place for conversations about things that you stop doing because somebody said something about them. It might be something as simple as like something like playing with girls. I'm a boy and I play with girls and somebody made fun of me once and I stopped doing it. Even something like I love rubbing my arms like this, or I love flapping my hands like this. And I stopped doing it because somebody made fun of me. The idea of protecting yourself and keeping your interests open, and listening to the people who connect with you over it and ignoring the people who don't. That's a really important sort of lesson of care, I think. I also just love sharing books that make students laugh. It's a real source of pleasure to me to read them a book that's very funny. And so there's a book that's called The Watermelon Seed, which is about a crocodile who eats a watermelon seed. Perhaps you've seen it. It's by Greg Pizzoli. And he becomes convinced that he's going to have a watermelon grow in his stomach. It's like a bar. It's a complete crowd pleaser. And also, it gives me a chance to talk about legends and urban legends and superstitions, which is a real area that I'm interested in and connects to like this magical thinking, which is very prevalent in kids and also people with OCD. So, you know, there's also the books that I read that tell true stories that kids don't know about and that they're completely shocked that they haven't heard about. That's a way that I care. I use those to deliver care in the sense that I feel very regretful about the lapses of American education and the lapses in Jewish education and how it leaves huge areas of experience completely unexplored and even hides certain facts. And so when I read kids' books that are about, like, you know, there's a book called I'm Not a Number by Jenny K. Dupuy, which is about Indian residential schools in Canada. And it's very accessible. It's not traumatizing. I mean, it's not traumatizing to anybody who's not a member of, you know, First Nations or who has had experience being taken from their parents. But kids are like, how could we not know about this? And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes certain stories, people think that people don't want to hear them. But really it's that publishers or parents don't want to read those to their kids. Or publishers don't think parents will want them, but parents do want them and kids do want to hear them. So I would say that I Am Not a Number is one of those books. Books about slavery, that sort of open that topic up because it's hard for, and colonialism, it's hard for middle schoolers to understand where America comes from if they don't understand those driving forces. Not every kid responds to the things that I responded to. So there have been books that I've really had to give up. Some fantasy books, because they take a really long time. And also because fantasy readers, you know, they love, in my experience, they love the aspect of feeling like a book is just for them. And so a book that they find on their shelf, or a book that they, you know, pick off the shelf at the bookstore, or a book that their, you know, their friend leaves behind at a sleepover. And so I would like to, I want to honor that. But there's a book that I insist on sharing with my students, which is called The 11th Hour by Graham Bass. And he's an Australian author. And it's filled with puzzles, and it's filled with codes, and it's to solve a mystery. And there's no guarantee you're going to solve it. It's quite difficult. My sister and brother and I worked on it for about 3 years as children, and I actually don't have any memory of whether we ever solved it. So I love sharing that book, and because it gives that quality of absorption, and kids who maybe have left their word search days behind, or who have left their puzzling days behind, or who have never really connected with those, have an opportunity to really get lost in what's it like to solve this puzzle? What's it like to make meaning out of something that apparently has no meaning? What's it like to try to prove that I'm right using evidence? So what's it like to know that I could find out the answer if I searched on the internet, but I'm not going to do that? So I think that hopefully that's a way of providing some kind of care and respite and stimulation to my students.
I look forward to writing down some of those book titles after we conclude our recording. Would you tell me a book that you received care from, or that you were cared for by hearing or reading when you were a child?
Well, there's a very funny example which I would like to share. I loved the Lord of the Rings books, and I wish I could remember the exact year, but at a certain year, I think I was 10 or 11 when the Blair Witch Project came out, and the lead up to that movie's release involved basically pretending as though it was real. It was presented as a true story. This was really found footage from a camera from like an abandoned shack. And these people had really been found, and their entrails had really been scraped from their bodies. And there really was a hex. And, you know, the whole thing. And this was in like the early days of information literacy on the internet. And so I had full access to all of that information, but I did not have access to any. So there was no social media. There was no platform where it was like, this is not real. There was just like the specific information. And then right before it was released, I went away to summer camp, and I went away to a sleeping out in the woods camp, and the woods was the setting for the Blair Witch Project. So I had my head filled with all these, you know, sort of ritualistic dismemberments, and I was convinced that they were real. And unsurprisingly, I was not a great sleeper as a child, and unsurprisingly, I could not sleep to save my life. And in fact, I was beset by just visions of being completely killed and tortured and all of these other things, like really vivid. So anyway, the one book that I had brought along with me was The Silmarillion, which was by J.R.R. Tolkien, and it's the mythology and sort of epics of the Lord of the Rings world. And I found it incredibly dry, and I really was bored by it. But while I was reading it, I was not experiencing visions of being murdered by the Blair Witch. And eventually I got really into it. And I, you know, I loved it, and I've traded off of my knowledge of, you know, the Silmarils and Morgoth and the Valar in like very specific contexts where I want to establish like nerd dominance, usually over men. So I benefited from it in that way. But in the immediate moment, I really was cared for by the ability to escape into this world where the stakes were high, but they were not personal. So maybe the entire universe was going to fall, but I was going to remain alive and safe. So I was really cared for by that book. And that was when I was 10 or 11, I think. Although going back over it, it may in fact turn out that that was a different year, as we know from our studies here. And There's so many, I mean, there's too many to think of, which is why this is taking a long time. I guess I would say there was a book that we had that was a treasury. It's by Nathan Ozabel, and it was either a treasury of Jewish humor or a treasury of Jewish stories. I think he's done both, actually. It was like Jewish folktales and stories, but it had a joke section. And I loved it because, first of all, it was huge, and I love big books. And I felt very like adult and grown up and gifted reading it. But it also made me feel very connected with my mom and with my mom's parents. And I felt like I was connecting with people from the past in some way. And that there was this music section, so it shared all these Yiddish lullabies. And there was, and it was also thematically organized in a way that I loved and found really refreshing, which was sort of like by folktale. What I later came to realize is like folktale type or joke type, and that structure became important to me. Like, I love reading collections that are all about like the Brave Sister, or that are all about like, you know, transforming, and you know, I love thematic collections like that. But that sense of, it was also a way that I like was performing Judaism, because I was growing up in an interfaith family. We were not super regular. We weren't really involved in temple life. We would go for services, but I wasn't part of any groups, and it was a way that I felt very connected to what I perceived of as being like my community and my heritage. So, yeah, it's a good book.
Would you like to close out our recording session today with your recollection of a folktale or a lullaby or a joke from that treasury?
Oh man, I would like to. There's so many. Which ones do I remember in enough detail to really? I'm trying to decide between like three right now, just to qualify the silence in some way. I guess there was one joke which I thought was hilarious, and nobody has ever found as hilarious as I found it. And it's in a back and forth dialogue setup, which is hard to perform, which I'm gonna say is why people don't think this joke is as hilarious as I do. So it's between two people, and one of them's like, it's a riddle. What's what's purple, striped, hangs on the wall, and whistles? And the person's like, I don't know. It's like, it's a herring. Well, herring isn't purple. You could paint it purple. Well, herring isn't striped. You could put stripes on it. Well, herring doesn't hang on the wall. You could hang it on the wall. Herring doesn't whistle. Okay, so it doesn't whistle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Although, I guess in the book, it's new, so it doesn't whistle. Which is a little, like, new is a very multivalent Yiddish word. It's mm-hmm. like, so what are you saying? I'm making a equivocating gesture with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's my favorite. That's one of my favorite jokes from that particular treasury.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It has for me too. Very grateful that we got to sit down for this today.
I feel very cared for in this interview.
Oh, thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you.